Welcome to Foul Players Radio, your podcast for arts, entertainment, and pop culture. My name is Michael Spedden, your host. Every episode features interesting people with fun, fascinating stories about their journeys in the performing arts. Authors, actors, dancers, writers, musicians, athletes, comics, you name it. Folks who are center stage, backstage, on camera, or behind the scenes. Sit back and listen. Let's have some fun. Foul Players Radio is a production of the Foul Players Group and a proud member of the SJ Network. And welcome again to the Rising from the Ashes edition of Foul Players Radio. My name is Michael Spedden. Jason Stewart was our guest today, and Jason shared some very interesting tales from his journey in the entertainment business as a result of a chance meeting with Shelley Winters, Sally Kirkland, and Skip E. Lowe. He ended up as an observer in the Actors Studio. In the 80s, he got into stand-up comedy, performing at the Comedy Store, and he performed with such comedians as Drew Carey, Margaret Cho, Sandra Bernhard, Richard Jenny, Shirley Hemphill, Stephanie Hodge, Judy Tenuta, Rick Overton, and Damon Wayans. His acting credits include a recurring role on My Wife and Kids as Dr. Thomas, also with Damon Wayans, The Drew Carey Show, The John Larroquette Show, Murder, She Wrote, Will and Grace, Charmed, more recently on Goliath with J.K. Simmons and Bruce Dern, Immortal with Sam Levine, and Smothered, which you can see on Amazon Prime. He is the author of Shut Up, I'm Talking, which is available on Amazon.com. Subscribe for free at www.foulplayersradio.com or listen on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Podcast Addict, Podchaser, Pocket Cast, Deezer, Listen Notes, Player FM, Pocket Cast Index, Overcast, Castro, Castbox, or Podfriend. Basically, anywhere you can find a podcast, you'll find us. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. The Foul Players of Perryville are now booking murder mystery shows for the late summer and fall of 2021. Indoor or outdoor venues, trains, boats, office parties, fundraisers, or just for the heck of it. 443-600-0446, www.foulplayersofperryville.com, or email us at foulplayersperryville@yahoo.com. And now, for the joke of the week. I've been criticized about this lately, not just because of the quality of the jokes, but is it the dumb joke of the week, the stupid joke of the week? Apparently, I can't keep the title of this segment right, so we'll just call it the joke of the week, and you decide whether it was good, bad, dumb, or stupid, or what have you. Old man Smithers had a teenage daughter, and one thing he learned about teenagers is that if you don't keep them busy and don't give them an outlet, they can be quite ornery. He decided to get her involved in the local 4-H club and bought her some piglets to raise. His daughter fell in love with the piglets, and together they went and built a shelter for them to live in. One night, the daughter was awakened by the smell of smoke, and she shouted to old man Smithers, "Daddy, the sty is burning!" They both ran outside to get the hose to try to put it out. Suddenly, old man Smithers grabbed his head, screamed, and collapsed on his daughter, pinning her to the ground and keeping her from getting to the hose. Fortunately, neighbors saw what was going on and called emergency services, and the fire department came and put out the fire, and the ambulance took old man Smithers to the hospital. Now, whenever there's some sort of action in a small town like that, the local paper always has to have a statement. The reporter went over to the fire chief and said, "Chief, can you tell us what happened at the Smithers place? Is old man Smithers going to be okay?" The fire chief turned to the reporter and said, "He had a stroke on the daughter and fire in the sty." Thank you. We'll be back with Jason Stewart right after these words.
Howdy, it's Matt Gwynn here, popping in to let you know about the adventures of the albino rhino. It's a show, Frank the Giraffe here, my co-host James Godwin, and myself put on for you guys twice a week. Every Wednesday, we talk to a comedian, and every Friday, we call it Freak Yeah Friday. The show itself is not safe for work, and that freak is definitely a different word. I just don't know what podcast you're going to be listening to this promo on. And I don't want to, you know, start screaming explicatives while you're sitting in your office. If you're lucky enough to have been able to go back to the work that you did before inside of an office or whatever, you know, but we go on an adventure twice a week and it's a good time because we get to sit down and talk to some really cool people. And I enjoy it because, you know, I'm just curious little albino who likes to get to know folks, you know? You can find us a couple ways. Actually, multiple ways, really. Man, there's a lot of different ways to find us. You can find us through our central hub, which is www.albinorhino.me. It's the website you can find me on. And then, you know, the podcast, you can find the videos on YouTube. Search for Adventures of the Albino Rhino. Also linkable from our website. And you can also find us through Anchor, Breaker, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Overcast, Radio Public, and Spotify. That's right. We're on the same place Joe Rogan is. Granted, we're not the Joe Rogan experience, but you know what I mean? We're there. So give us a listen. Promise you won't be dissatisfied. And enjoy your day.
What is going on, minions? Mike here for Misery Point Radio, and you're listening to the Coast to Coast Power Hour on the SJ Network. Now, I know what you're thinking. Mike, what the F is a Coast to Coast Power Hour? Well, my uneducated and uninformed friend, the Coast to Coast Power Hour is a Borg-like collective of epic podcasters from epic podcasts that have all come together to discuss the important things in life. Pop culture, current events, random awesomeness, stuff like that. Trust me, you need this in your life. For more information on this show and all the shows on the Coast to Coast Power Hour, as well as on the SJ Network, reach out to publicist Steve Joyner at www.s-j-network.com or stevesjnetwork@gmail.com. No need to thank me. I'm just out here, you know, changing lives.
What's Your Effin' Binge is a podcast brought to you by Chris, Anchor, and Spotify. And what we talk to our guests about is what they're currently binge-watching on TV. And what we do is we like to take a different approach. I don't want to know what the name of the show is that they're going to talk about before they come on. I have to actually guess it. So I ask them who, what, when, where, why, and try to figure out what it is that they're watching. A lot of times I'm able to guess it, and sometimes I'm not. And that's fine. That adds to the comedy of the show. We like to bring our guest on, whether they're a model or an actress or a producer or musician, and just let them have a platform to be able to tell everybody what they have coming up next, and also entertain everybody with what's worth watching. So I hope everybody tunes in for the next episode of What's Your Effin' Binge. Thanks. It's Chris.
So, Jason, welcome to Foul Players Radio. It's great to have you. I have to say, I've been watching a lot of your comedy online, and you're one hell of a comedian. You're really funny. So, well, welcome.
Thank you very much. You're too kind.
Now, what did you do first? I was looking through all the things that you've sent me here. You've given me a pretty extensive bio, like, of the things you've done. You said 250 credits on your IMDb page, which kind of reads like War and Peace. And, you know, your stand-up. What was the first thing you did? Did you start in theater?
Well, actor first. Actor is my roots.
Okay.
That's where I come from. It's sort of like if you hear Shirley MacLaine talk, she'll say she's a dancer first, even though she's known more for an actress. Or Streisand sees herself as an actress first, though she is known, you know, of course, as a singer.
Certainly.
So yeah. I had gotten famous for being a comedian, but I feel that my roots are being an actor. That's where I really, that's where I come from.
Interesting. What
was the first acting job I ever did, mm-hmm. professionally or non-professionally?
Whatever. Either one is fine. Tell me both.
Before we started this, you got to hear my mother. So non-professionally, I did a Purim play that was written by my temple, and I played a Temple's slave, and I ripped up one of her sheets, and that was my costume. She's never forgiven me. That's my first professional, my debut in the theater. Non-professional. My first professional gig was, I guest starred on a TV show called Life and Times of Eddie Roberts, which mm-hmm. was called Later. That was the initials Later. It starred Rennie Temple, who was a big improv star, Billy Barty. And it was a sort of nighttime comedy soap opera that replaced Mary Hartman. And I had a guest starring role in it in 1979.
Is that right?
And I had a different name even at the time. They spelled my name wrong in the credits. my real name is Stuart Greif. And they spelled it Stuart Grief. And 3 months later, I had 3 months rather before, I had gone to Schwab's drugstore, which is across the street from, in Hollywood, it's across the street from the Laugh Factory, where I've worked for years on and off. And I'd gone there before they tore it down. And in those days, you would go in there and you'd wait in line for lunch. It was very busy. Mm-hmm. And you'd sit European style. So they'd stick you at any table. And they stuck me at a table. Well, I sort of manipulated it because I waited to see that I could get in. And I sat at a table with Shelley Winters, Sally Kirkland.
Oh, wow.
And Skippy Lowe, who was a public access TV show host. Okay. He was one of the first to do those kind of public access shows. Skippy Lowe talks to Hollywood. Okay. And we're all black. And, and he'd say things like, Michael, so you live in Maryland with your wife, who's also in show business. Tell us, were you molested as a child? And then out of nowhere. Sally Kirkland was sitting there eating a piece of cheese. How she got them to bring her just a piece of cheese is beyond me. Later, of course, people know that she was nominated for an Academy Award for Anna and was in Ron Howard's film, Ed TV, and just has worked with almost everybody. Mm-hmm. And, of course, two-time Academy Award and Emmy winner, Shelley Winters, who I knew from the Poseidon Adventure and mm-hmm. Patch of Blue and Place in the Sun and Diary of Anne Frank. And she's sitting there and I sat and they were all talking about some actress that they thought was going to be a very big star. Her name was, I think it was something like Meryl Streep, something like that.
Oh.
She had been in this movie called, The Deer Hunter, some little movie. And I sat next to her and she turned over and she said, who are you? And I said, I'm Stuart Greif. She said, what? I said, Stuart Ted Greif. That's my name. She says, well, that's a stupid name for a cute kid. And she made me a observer at the Actors Studio. She was on the board there. Oh. And I went there for a year. And then I saw her again in New York and she didn't remember who I was. And 3 months later, I got my first acting job in it. Film called TV show called Life and Times of Eddie Roberts. Mm-hmm. And in the credits, they spelled my name Stuart Grief.
Oh, geez.
And I changed my name to Jason Stewart that day.
That's one of those things I understand. I looked in IMDb when I first got professional management. There was like 8 or 10 other people with my real name. And so I changed it.
What's your real name?
Mike Barton. Barton.
Oh, okay.
And there was like, all kinds of like Mike Michaels and, like Michael Bartons, Mike Bartons. And I would have been like,
is your wife's name Speedon?
No. Speedon is my great grandmother's maiden name.
Oh.
And my wife uses her maiden name, actually Cantone, Teresa Cantone, in her acting credits and everything. But that was the reason I changed it too, because there were no Michael Speedons on IMDb. I'm the only one. And if I, when the time comes when I join SAG, I don't want to have to change my name or use that middle initial or whatever.
Well, they don't do that anymore. You don't have to, you can have the same name as somebody now.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
And if anybody wants to read that whole story, it's in my autobiography that came out last year called Shut Up, I'm Talking.
Hey, at the end of the show, I'll make sure that you tell us where we can get that too.
Amazon.
Yeah, Amazon. Of course, that's where you get everything nowadays, isn't it?
Mothership. Yeah. Well, yeah. It's everywhere else. It's through CCB Publishing. But nowadays, everybody buys everything at Amazon, and you get 2 cents, and then Amazon gets everything.
Yeah, isn't that the truth? I'm a musician, and I know because I was selling stuff on there, too. And, oh, yeah. That's really how they get you. Well, you know, the thing that really kills you when you're a musician is the live streaming. Or the streaming of your material, because you get like a tenth of a cent or something like that for every stream. And, you know, people could listen to it for hours. You end up getting maybe a dime.
It's terrible.
In royalties. Really, yeah. That's pretty rough. So you got yourself into acting, and did you start stand up after you've been in getting established in television for a while, or was that something you were doing all along?
Stand up, I had a manager named Catherine James that thought that I would be good at that, and I had no training in that area. I had gone to the Comedy Store 2 years before, and Robert Aguayo and another incredible talented Danny Mora were having they had a workshop on Saturday afternoons, and I went in there. And I did my, 5 minutes, and they thought I was just horrific. Mm-hmm. And they ripped me to shreds. And I was so nervous. I didn't go back for years later. And then she talked me into doing it. She set me up an audition at the Comedy Store. I went on before Damon Wayans.
Oh.
Little did I know that I'd be working with him, God, 15 years later, I'd be on a recurring on his series. But, and I went on, and I was so nervous I was funny, and I was made a non-paid showcasing regular, which would have been the lowest
right
yet to be able to work there.
Right. So that was around what year was that you started working the Comedy Store? Was that
1983?
83. Okay. And that was when I guess Mitzi Shore, of course, was the owner.
Of course. Yeah. She was the owner. She was the one that would sit there and go, "Why don't you wear a funny hat? Yeah. That's what you need is a funny hat."
Okay. That's funny.
I was trying to say to her, "I don't want to take what you have because you're wearing a funny hat." She goes, "No, that's my hair." God bless
her. Yeah. Oh, yeah. She's a very storied person. I hear a lot about her from different people that have performed out there.
She was all over the place. She loved the comedians, and she loved the straight boys, and she had affairs, and she made people's careers, and, she was the gatekeeper.
Right. Right. So who were some of your contemporaries you performed with out there at the time?
Well, I'd say Drew Carey, Damon Wayans, of course. So many. Oh, everybody got TV series deals. And there were so many, that were a little above me that I'd see. I'd see all the time. Sandra Bernhard, I'd see all the time. Margaret Cho was my contemporary.
Oh, okay.
So many wonderful ones.
Oh, yeah. That the 80s, and that was my time coming up in music and everything, too. I was in hair bands on the East Coast in the 80s and early 90s. And there was just something about that era, on the East Coast, all over the place in entertainment, that I thought was really just magical.
It felt like it's so funny. Being a gay person in those days was always so scary.
Oh,
it didn't feel magical to me. It always felt scary. I was always afraid that I was going to get fired, so I could never really enjoy myself. There were some magical times. That Stephanie Hodge, I remember I worked with her from, Happily Ever After, and just so many, Richard Jenny, I'd work with him, Shirley Hemphill. There were wonderful people that I opened for in the day. Judy Tenuta, who I'm still friendly with. Mm-hmm. It was great. I'd never been out of California since I'd been a kid, other than going back to New York. So it really was a real lesson in the way the rest of the country behaved.
Huh. Interesting. I've had as guests a number of people that were performing in that circuit during that time. And the one thing that was kind of similar between, the comedy folks out there and, the bands on the East Coast was, it was kind of a tight-knit group. And whenever somebody got like a break or a good, step up in the right direction, it seems like everybody else, their peers and their contemporaries kind of rallied around them and would kind of cheer them on. I mean, there was
I think that happens a lot with people. Not everyone. There's some people that have a hard time with success. I'm still friendly with Tiffany Haddish, who I've known forever. There are other comedians that I know that you know, work a lot. They're not as successful. Rick Overton, I know, and mm-hmm. you know, and so many others. You know, it's just people. We're all people.
Yeah. Yeah. The one thing that I, you know, heard quite a bit about was, you know, in these clubs, like, you know, like the Improv and the Comedy Store, you know, whenever somebody got a chance to go on something like, you know, like Carson or something like that, everybody would, you know, watch them on TV and, you know, kind of cheer for them, you know, kind of be there for them and to support them with that. Was that, did you experience that as well? Or
well, they wouldn't let, there was no room for gay people on talk shows in those days. So and there was one particular club owner, a club booker rather, who when he had gotten the job working on one of the big talk shows, I said, hey, is this may be a time for me? And he said, well, if you could do the show without being gay.
Huh.
That was so for me, that there was not a lot of support in that area.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
You know, when you're a minority person, it's different.
Hmm.
And I don't think people do it purposely. I think it's sort of a birds of a feather kind of thing.
Hmm.
Dane Cook was a contemporary, really great guy to me. Still, I just talked to him the other day. And, you know, they're just wonderful people.
Hmm. But,
you know, then some people, it's like anything, I think. I don't think there's one way. But I have to say that actors and comedians have been, pretty much half of my success.
Right.
And the other from people in the business who are writer, producer, directors, casting, and sort.
Interesting. You had mentioned working with Damon Wayans, and you ended up on a show with him. I think it was called My Wife and Kids or something.
Yeah, I recurred on that show as Dr. Thomas. And yeah. That was a really big changing point in my career because before that, I'd only had, you know, small parts or guest spots on different sitcoms and an occasional drama like Charm, but I was always this sort of funny or quirky person.
Mm-hmm.
And I had gotten a call from my agent. I was doing a gig at the Russian River, and I got a call from him on my service or my machine in those days, you know.
Huh. Yeah.
I called him back and he said, hey, they want you for My Wife and Kids. And I said, well, when do I go to the audition? And they said, no, they want you for the part. I said, What do you mean? It's the first time I'd ever been offered anything.
Oh, wow.
And except for my first movie, which was one line, which my manager got me. But I guess I thank Jim Vallelet and Bruce Fine and Damon Wayans and Kim Wayans and everybody and Don Rio and everybody in that room when they said my name for this part. They said, yeah, that's the one. And I got it.
Oh, good. Good. I hear you.
Extraordinary experience from beginning to end. It was one of those times that I could do no wrong.
Oh, great. Great. Did I hear the Wayans are really wonderful to work with. Was that your experience too?
Oh yeah. You know, Damon wants you to do well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. I had heard that a bit. You know, I've heard, you know, like other interviews and when I'm not interviewing people, I'm listening to similar shows, you know, with, you know, when I see somebody I like is being interviewed. And I've heard that come from quite a few people that the day and that all of the Wayans are really they're good people and they really, you know, look out for you and they want you to be, like you had said, you know, they want you to be successful. Mm-hmm. You know, well, that's great. So looking through your, you know, bio a little bit more here, you had been in a historical drama, you were in Birth of a Nation. Was that a remake of the earlier, I had heard of Birth of a Nation out like 100 years ago.
No, not at all.
No,
it was about taking back the title from the film because if you know the history of that film,
I had heard of it.
It created a the Ku Klux Klan had almost disappeared by then, and it created a new Ku Klux Klan at that time.
Uh-huh.
And it sort of was the film was almost like a breeding ground for that,
right?
And it really was not the story of Black people at that time.
Sure.
And that Nate Parker had wrote, produced, starred, and directed this film. I got the film because I had contacted different agents all over the country because I knew that I was not going to get a part by just staying in Los Angeles. People were not going to let me play anything that was more than a funny gay guy or uptight manager or something. mm-hmm. or a fussy hotel clerk, and there is no big movies about them.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I had gotten this audition one night from my agent mm-hmm. in New Orleans, Brenda, and I remember getting the email thinking, oh God, no one's going to let me play a plantation owner, a white heterosexual Christian plantation owner in 1831 when I'm a gay liberal Jew. And I remember I was going to a gig with a couple of friends. We were in a car. We'd stopped at a 7-Eleven and I checked my phone. And it was 2015 at the time. And she said, oh, so I called my assistant because I had an assistant at that time who was coming over to help work with me the next day. And I said, get here at 9 instead of at 10. We have to get this into them by noon. Mm-hmm. So I got him over. I worked on it, sent the tape over, forgot about it. A week later, I get a call. Some guy named Nate Parker wants to meet me. I get a cheap flight, you know, frequent flyer out of to go to Savannah. I mm-hmm. rent some cheap, you know, rent a wreck. Stay in this flea-bitten motel, right, where a gal in front of the, you know, hotel's mm-hmm. sitting there pregnant and smoking, and then there's some guy by the pool, looks like he's going to kill me in my sleep.
I think I've been there before.
Oh, yeah. And I'm practicing the N-word over and over again because I've never said it out loud in my life. And I hear a knock at the door, and it's the housekeeper. She says, what's going on in there? I said, oh, nothing, just a bunch of Republicans talking on TV. Then the next day, I drive to this strip mall, mm-hmm. and I go have lunch. I'm 3 hours early. Then I go in the parking lot, and I start to rehearse the scene. And some guy comes over to me, goes, I know you. And I said, oh, my God, I have a fan in somewhere a half hour out of Savannah, Georgia, in a parking lot of a strip mall. It was Nate Parker, and he looked me into his eyes and he said something. He's so handsome and he has this cool, you know, incredible energy and this sort of charismatic personality. And I don't know what he said, but whatever it was, it calmed me down. Mm-hmm. I went in, I did the part. He said, can you do it again? This guy is he's very much of a big blustery guy. He's sort of, and he thinks he's funny. And I thought, mm-hmm. nightclub comedian, you think I can't? Funny? I could do funny.
Oh, of course.
So I did it again. I added some comedy to it. I said, can I start in the scene before? They only wanted me to do the monologue. He said, sure. And I knew that I needed the run, you know, up the block in it. And I would not have done that, you know, unless I had really worked on my work as an actor. Hmm. You know, I wouldn't have had the gumption to do that. So I read it. I said, thank you very much. And then the next day I get back to LA, I get a call and from my agent's assistant, because my agent was gone. And she says, how are you doing? I said, fine. She says, well, how's your day? I said, well, it's going okay. She says, well, it's about to get a lot better. I said, well, why? She says, well, you got the part. And I literally said, what part? I didn't think it was going to be that part. Huh. And she said, the plantation owner. I said, don't you lie to me. And she said, no, I'm telling you the God's honest truth. Huh. And I got the part, and I just broke down and I started to cry.
Huh.
Cried like a baby. And then I got real scared because now I knew I had to do it. And I worked with a different actor friend every day for 7 days. And then I flew to another friend's house in Georgia, right next to Georgia Savannah, where we were shooting Jacksonville, Florida. It was around an hour and 45 minutes away. Mm-hmm. And I went to go stay with him and I rented another car. And I said, hey, if you have a table read or, you know, if the director has a moment to meet with me, I'd like to talk to him about the part before I go, you know, before we start the film that following Monday. And I was starting on the second day, and I was there to come the day they start to do wardrobe fittings. And she said, his assistant, who happens to be Denzel Washington's daughter, which I did not know. Mm-hmm. And she set up an appointment for me, and I went in, and he was in this house. It looked like the Waltons or some family Thanksgiving, people were running around. It was a Sunday, and he was barefoot, and his kids were running around. He had three or four small children. His mom was there, and his cousins, and it was like a family thing. And he took me, he put on some shoes, and he took me up to this office above the garage, and he was in a swivel chair just like I'm in. And he said, he went to get the script. And I said to him, thank you so much for hiring me. And he said to me, no, thank you. And I almost lost it, you know, because people had never talked to me like that. You know, usually go in, you do your part, you leave. No one says, hey, God, we really loved you. You know, we not a lot of, you know, slaps on the back or, you know, a little squeeze of a shoulder in this business.
Yeah.
By the people that hire you. And I was just so moved. And then there was the process of making the film. It was extraordinary. Hmm. One of the best artistic experiences I've ever had. Great producers. I walked in and Nate's acting coach said to me, he knew me. And he said, how'd you get that accent? I said, well, I don't know. Roots.
right.
You know, and we became fast friends. And I did the film, and then it went to Sundance, and people stood up and clapped for it. It was one of the most extraordinary feelings to be on this. He didn't, and Nate was such a family guy. He didn't bring, you know, just one person on stage, one big star maybe, or the couple of stars and the couple of the big producers. That's what most people do. He brought the entire cast and crew, everyone from the star of the film, you know, Penelope Ann Miller and Armie Hammer and, you know, Roger Gander Smith and Asia Naomi King and all these great people and all the producers, but people who had been, you know, had one line in the film, people that were assistants, people, anybody that was in town. And it was extraordinary. Huh. It was just so kind and generous to have us all be a part of that moment. And the actual film is on YouTube. You know, if you see me do it, you see me pulling my shirt. I didn't know what to wear to this. I was just so upset with myself. I couldn't figure what to wear, what to do. It was just, I was crazy. Huh.
I see that you've worked with, you know, a couple of other people here, such as J.K. Simmons and Billy Bob Thornton on Goliath. What was that like?
I just did that a couple months ago. I play a Charles, who's the head of a pharmaceutical company. I'm the head of the board. And I have a scene with J.K. Simmons. And it's funny because I turned down an audition for a part with him, not a part, a scene with him where I would play a bartender. It was one line and I turned it down. And because I don't want to do that. And they said, and the agent said, well, you should. It's J.K. Simmons. I said, yeah, but I'm just saying, here's your drink. They'll cut it off me. I'm not going to be in the scene and it'll be weird. You know? And I'll want to do more. And they won't let me, and I'll hate it. And then, of course, this came up, and he's the head, you know, guest star that has the recurring on the show for this season. He's the arc, and Bruce Dern plays my boss.
Oh,
so he walks by me, and in this sort of the first part of my scene, after I give all this dialogue, he comes in and he says, well, Charles, this is what he thinks, and da 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 da. And he looks at me, and you know, and I'm thinking, God, I'm acting with Bruce Dern from Coming Home in Nebraska, and they shoot Horses, Don't They, in Black Sunday, and you know, Middle Age Crazy, and all these films that I saw as a kid. And then by the third take, he came in and he said, well, Charlie, is this and that. And I'm thinking, oh my God. And then he's giving me this look, and we're acting together, and it's like, I almost died. Died and went to heaven.
Wow.
I didn't get to meet Billy Bob Thornton, though, unfortunately.
Yeah, yeah. That's one of those things that happens sometimes.
COVID too, because it was COVID. Mm-hmm. You know, we were all wearing, you know, face masks and shields, and it was right when they just started opening all this up in September, October, I did it.
Oh, okay. I was looking at the list here, and, you know, again, there was a lot of things shut down, but there were quite a few projects that were up and running and were getting released last year and everything.
It hasn't been on TV yet. It will be in this year, I'm guessing. I don't know when. It's season 4, episode 6, I believe.
Okay. We'll keep an eye out for it. Definitely. We'll definitely keep an eye out for it. As I was looking through here a little more too, I see that I've been working on the show called Immortal. Sam Levine.
For Fixing Geeks and Inglourious Basterds. He's a wonderful, wonderful
actor. Yeah.
And I play private investigator who deals with spyware. And he plays one of the four people in this film that cannot die. And I have this incredible 6-minute scene with him. Mm-hmm. What all it said is about the character, two things. He said that I was intimidating and had a low voice. Mm-hmm. So that's all I had. So I really got my character totally from Sam. Mm-hmm. And he was just wonderful to work with. And it was, and John DeBall is the director, and he was just terrific. DeBach, I'm saying it wrong, DeBach. Mm-hmm. It was my thing of what I called head acting, because people don't realize if I were doing this and just doing this and talking and all of a sudden all these things and saying things and talking, you know, in the shot and saying how much I like you, it would be like, oh God, the shot would look so weird. Uh-huh. And we don't get, and also in life, people don't often do that.
Right.
Behave in that manner. And when you move around a lot, it takes away your power and it weakens the character. So I remember when I did it, I thought, God, I hope I didn't do too, you know. But then when he went in tight on the eyes, you know, man, it's one of my favorite things I've done.
You had mentioned that you had gotten the chance.
That's available on, you can watch that film on Amazon and all the other platforms. It's everywhere now.
That sounds great. Kind of going back to something you'd mentioned earlier, you had the opportunity through being at the table with Sally Kirkland and Shelley Winters. She got you the opportunity to visit the Actor's Studio and, you know, study there. Who did you study under there?
Well, I was an observer.
Martin
Landau was one of the instructors.
Okay.
Lee Grant, Joanna Nails, and Lee Strasberg came one summer. And he wore his shirt buttoned to the top, and he sweated the whole time in this little room that they had off in this little teeny park, you know, above in the Hollywood Hills, below Sunset Boulevard. And it was sort of extraordinary. I think the era of the Actor's Studio is over, I'm afraid. So many other coaches have become so popular. I've studied with some great people like Ivana Chubbuck and Howard Fine and Larry Moss. You know, I think the Actor's Studio, a lot of the people have passed or
in
their 90s now. So I don't know if what's going on there of late. A number of years ago, I also observed for another year, thinking I was going to go back because I was supposed to do a play. And Martin Landau uncast me in the play.
Huh.
Never met me, never saw me, but because I wasn't an Actor's Studio member.
Oh.
But he did make me an observer. So I was made an observer by two Academy Award winning actors.
So when you're an observer there, that means you're almost like auditing the class. You get to watch, but you're not participating.
You watch extraordinary work, and then you have the opportunity to audition.
Okay.
And it's funny, every time I had the opportunity and I put into audition, I'd get some job and I couldn't do it. Isn't that terrible?
Yeah, I know. One thing I like to ask people, though, is, and again, I have all kinds of performers on here. I have, you know, people in bands. I have bands on. I have, actors, singers. I've had belly dancers on. One thing I kind of like to ask about, and I kind of classify these as, like when I ask bands, like kind of like Spinal Tap moments. Have you ever been in a performance or been anywhere performing where something god awful goes wrong and you've had
to? Oh my God. Are you kidding me? No, it's always been perfect. Nothing has ever happened. It's always been just a perfect you know, night and a perfect performance, and every show I did, the laughs are just, you know, oh God. Once I was doing a show in a place in Merced, California. Mm-hmm. And this is the one this is when I met my biggest fan, Medea Yorba, who I'm still in contact with, who, there was a guy in the front row. I was the headliner. It was a one-nighter. Mm-hmm. It was in a bar that had a stage in the corner. And this guy was smoking. And, you know, that's when people smoked in clubs.
Right, right.
And his wife was coughing the whole time. Mm-hmm. She really couldn't handle it. And he didn't seem to care. So the opening act goes up. You know, the featured act goes up. And then during the featured act, she completely has an asthma attack and they have to call the ambulance to come.
Oh no.
And then the club owner says, "Now, Jason, you have to go on stage and save this." And then, you know, it's like people are walking out. It's like, you know, it's not a comedy atmosphere. So I got on stage and he's still there. He didn't go with his wife. And I, first thing I say is, well, everybody, she's going to be fine. And apparently her husband is still here. I don't know whether he knows where he is. So laugh. And I remember saying, do you know that your wife is gone? He says, "Oh yeah, I can't stand her." And I thought, really? I said, well, you know, could you smoke a little more? I said, everyone here doesn't have cancer yet. And he jumped at me. And then this other guy who was a fan of mine stood up in front of him, a big, big guy, and jumped, and he almost hit me. And then this guy hit him, and then Medea screamed and threw a drink in his face. And it was crazy. And then I had to go on and continue with the show after that. So I wouldn't have got my, you know, $250 or whatever it was at the time.
Jeez, a whiz, being physically attacked. We haven't had that one yet.
Well, I've been, you know, that's happened a lot. Lisa Vanderbilt's husband almost hit me up because I was hosting the West Hollywood Chamber of Commerce Awards. Mm-hmm. And it was these five people who had businesses. And they said they were all donated money and they got this award to West Hollywood. So I made jokes about everybody. One was a columnist. One was the hospital. The actual hospital got the award. And then it was Lisa Vanderpump, I believe is her name. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know much about the Housewives show. I don't watch those shows.
Right.
I'm a bit of a snob. So I came on stage and I said, "I don't know Lisa well, but I know that she's the one that didn't go to jail." Because she's here tonight. And she has taken this corner in West Hollywood and she has turned it over. She has made this, because this corner apparently had a history of having restaurants that failed.
Oh.
So I kept saying how she failed, but she took it. She worked that corner and, you know, I sort of inference that she was a pro of sorts, that she's just a professional and she knows what she's doing. And she came there and did this. And he, you know, and I guess calling her almost a prostitute. But it was a joke, and the audience was loving it. Mm-hmm. Then she came up, and we joked about her hair and her shoes and just sort of silly stuff. Mm-hmm. And after the show, and the audience loved it, because I would never continue to do something if it wasn't working. Mm-hmm. And he came over, and he said, "You're the worst comedian I've ever seen in my entire life, and you shouldn't be doing comedy ever anywhere. And the fact that you are is just, you know, the worst thing since Jesus Christ was killed." I mean, he was so upset. And then he tried to hit me.
Wow.
I mean, he was so mad. I guess he was drunk. And then he had two real, and I don't say this lightly, two very bitchy little queens with him, those kind of, and they were just so mad at me, you know. And I always said, if I were Margaret Cho or Kathy Griffin, they'd be masturbating in a circle. You know, they have to do whatever they want. But if a gay man says something, you know, and that was really, they called me the people that, you know, hired me and apologized. Mm-hmm. Of course, I said it wasn't their fault. But you know,
boy,
that was weird.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. I'd never heard of, you know, physical attacks and things like that. You know, I've had, some verbal attacks, and I've had a couple of things happen that were, you know, kind of funny on stage, but never any physical threats like that. That's a new one here for us on the show. So, Jason,
I think it's because I'm a gay man, and I think that you're allowed to do that.
Huh?
You know?
Wow. Yeah.
Whereas I've never heard of it happening to straight people. Also a straight comedian very much. Huh. If you're a minority person, you're not an equal to a lot of people. And comedy is a boys' club. Huh. And you have to do things their way. It's still that way. You will go into a major comedy club and you will see only maybe one woman on the bill and four guys.
Huh.
And rarely do you see a gay person.
Huh.
And that's the way it is. It still has not changed. We haven't evolved. The good thing that's evolved is there are people of color. The minorities have certainly, that's happened quite a bit. But when you do, Tiffany Haddish, an old pal, had just won the Grammy for best comedy album for her
Black
Christmas special. And she was told while she was working on the set of Kids Say the Darnest Thing, the show that she hosts. And they told her she won. And you see her, she just, you know, you see that her face, and it means so much more than just her winning. And a black woman has not won that award since 1986, when Whoopi Goldberg won for her one person show. And then before that, it was Kathy Griffin who had won maybe 5-6 years ago. So women hardly ever win.
Right. Right.
It's still, you know, 5-1. It's just a shame.
Yeah. I mean, there are definitely a lot of funny people out there, because I've performed with a lot of them, and talented in many, many ways, you know, not just in comedy, but also
how much you liked certain comedy things that I did. And you were not what people would think would be my target audience. A straight man in his, I'm guessing you're what, in your 40s?
51. But thank you. I appreciate that.
They wouldn't say you were my target audience.
Well, you know, funny was funny. You know, I mean, it was good. You know, I was listening to it, and I listened to a whole bunch of your routines and everything. And I thought it was great. You know, I mean, you really knew how to work the crowd. I mean, you were coming up with stuff that was, it was good stuff that you came up with. You know, I mean, you're very skilled at this. I have to say, not only, the material and stuff like that, but just, you're a good technician, I think. If that makes sense to you, I really think so,
Well, it's a craft. Everything's a craft. And I don't always succeed, but I try my best to be the best that I can be.
Yeah, it really is. It really, and the thing, the one thing I really admired about you the most is that, I'll tell you, this is your show, but I'll just tell you a little bit about me and kind of where I'm coming from on this. I played in bands for years. I stopped doing full bands, but I have an acoustic duo. It's me and another fellow, my friend Johnny, and we play acoustic guitar. And we do songs that are silly ditties. They're kind of comedy songs. We're not up there telling jokes and things like you are. We have our guitars that we can fall back on. We play guitar harmonics, kind of folky music, silly songs. And I can banter with the crowd in between songs. But the thing is, it's like sometimes if something runs out of gas, or if I go nowhere with banter with the crowd, or if I don't have anything funny to say, I could just go into another song. You, on the other hand, you've had, this whole crowd of people, and you're just constantly boom, 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 boom. And you're killing on every one of them.
No, it's not always. I'm not going to put up the tapes where I didn't.
Well, yeah. I mean, we all have those, but I was just really watching, but there's quite a few different, recordings of you out there. And it's not like you're just, doing a whole scripted show or anything like that. I mean, you're working the crowd and going along with what's out there. That's definitely a skill. I have it a little bit, but you are a real pro at it, you know, and that's something that I really
got to be in the moment, I believe,
you know, and you're right too. You're right too. I mean, cause there's, you know, there's a lot of training,
I think.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a lot of times too, when you come up with something while you're up there too, you know, it just comes to you, or sometimes, you know, sometimes a crowd member just walks right into it as well, you know, and you just happen to point it out.
I walk right into it and I use something I've used before and you guys think it's something. And my job is to make it seem like it's just for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You'd be surprised.
Yeah. That's Wow.
It's a little bit of a, you know, sleight of hand at times too. It may have come from something, because I always think when I do a show, there's always five, you know, gay guys in the audience that are just as funny as I am. The only thing is they don't know how to repeat it.
Well, I would like to thank you for being willing to spend time with us tonight here, Jason. Really think your comedy is just great. I'm looking forward to, you know, checking out, you know, the shows that you have coming out and the things that you mentioned. This is the time of the show when we like to give our guests the opportunity to shamelessly plug anything and be as shameless as they would like to be, with all shamelessness or no shamelessness held back.
Well, I don't feel any shame. Okay. I feel good about this. I have a series that I co-produced, co-star with my pal, the brilliant Mitch Hara. It's called Smothered, and it's about these two guys who've been in a relationship for 30 years who hate each other but can't afford to get divorced. You can see that on Amazon Prime. It's 7 5-minute episodes. We created that, and we're in the process of creating the second season. It's really off the wall, completely funny. If you like David O. Russell films and you'd like Fleabag and you like Curb Your Enthusiasm or Schitt's Creek, it's very much in those veins.
Oh, nice, nice. I like that list you just read.
Yeah, it's all things that we loved, you know. If you want to know more about me, you can get my book, Shut Up, I'm Talking, with a name that is, was given to me by my mom. It was supposed to be called I'm Not Barbara Streisand. And the publisher said, you can't do that. She'll be upset. I go, oh, that's great. He said, no, you know, you don't, we'll get sued. And she goes, no, we don't want to get sued. Mm. I said, we'll get a lot of press. No, we don't want that. So I said, Ma, I called her. I said, what am I going to do? You know, I love this title so much. She says, oh, I don't know. I said, come on, Ma, think of another. Oh, shut up, I'm talking. And that's how the title came. And then I have a new comedy CD out that just came out. It's called I'm the Daddy and I Have Candy. Mm-hmm. And it really is a re-release of something I tried to do by myself 5 years ago, but I didn't know how to do it. And the same company that released my first CD, Gay Comedy Without a Dress, is releasing it. So it's all over the internet. Everything is available through my website, jasonstewart.com, STUART. Mm-hmm. The book, the series, and the comedy CD. And you can just click there and you'll be able to see where everything is, shop, Smothered, the book, and that kind of thing. Hmm. And you'll be able to buy it. I also, all my social media is also on my website, which is jasonstewart.com, STUART. Mm-hmm. I said that, didn't I? I wonder whether I took a PM Tylenol by accident.
Jeez, yeah. Those things can be tough. So, well, Jason, again, thank you so much. You know, I thank you for, you know, sharing the time with us and telling us your stories and everything. I really enjoyed having you, and come back anytime. Come back anytime. You know, you can consider us part of your Rolodex now, if you still, remember what those things are. Anything you need, anytime you need to come on to plug or promote anything, we're here for you, buddy. Okay.
Well, thank you.
Folks, we've just heard Jason Stewart here on Foul Players Radio, and we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening.